Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
This has been an interesting show. It just flew by. I don't know what happened. I look up, we're in the happy hour, the 2 o'clock hour. John Wilner, nobody happier, joining us. Bay Area News Group, San Jose Mercury News. He's been on the phone all day doing radio interviews, no doubt, because he broke a big story this morning. He's got the Pac-12's plan to play a 10-game conference schedule, and he's joining us now. I hope you had some caffeine.
Yeah, plenty of caffeine, as always.
What did you learn?
Well, the big thing, if you take away, I think they're still working on the specific matchups week to week, but they have the framework in place. They want to play 10 games. They want to start in the middle of September. And they want to give themselves as much time to get those 10 games in as they can. And I think the big takeaway is the flexibility that they're trying to allow. You know, hope to start as early as possible. Give yourself a chance to finish as late as possible. And then within that calendar of 14 weeks, try to get as many games in as you can. That's basically what it is.
Does it feel like that's a concrete plan? Or does it feel more like this is them wishing and hoping?
How about both? I mean, I think that they do have, if you are going to come up with a concrete plan, I think this is the best you can do. You know, they have got 3 weeks that they could play their conference championship game so that if they need extra time in December for makeup games, they can push the title game back all the way to December 19th. So it's a good concrete plan. It's sound, even if they can't play the first couple weeks of September. You know, they could still get 8 or 9 games in starting in October. But at the same time, I mean, there's certainly a ton of wishful thinking. I mean, that's the entire industry of college football is in wishful thinking mode at this point, right, with the virus. But I think that they feel like they don't want to just abandon playing in the fall until they're sure that they can't. And they're not at this point sure that they can't play. Even if it's October, they're not sure they can't play yet.
John Wilner with us, San Jose Mercury News. Wilner, as I sort of look at, you know, the Pac-12's plan, and as you laid it out, it looks like it's 5 non-division games, plus you play everybody in your division. That's the plan, and they leave themselves some bye weeks, and then there are some multiple opportunities to play the conference championship game. It feels like, you know, it really is just a flexibility option. Is that a plan that they want to play right now in the fall, or is that a plan that could also be played in the spring?
I think that's a great point. This is certainly the blueprint for what we might see in the spring. If they can't play, you know, if it's just not safe on the campus or within the campus communities more broadly, and public health officials say you can't play, this is something that they could take and basically drop down into, you know, take your pick, late January, early mid-February, start up with something like that. Conference only with, as many weeks as possible to get in a decent amount of games, right? I mean, I think they would love to get 8 games in. To me, that feels like it would be a legitimate season because, I mean, the SEC plays 8 conference games. So if the Pac-12 got 8 conference games, then that would feel legitimate. And this is the kind of plan that would allow them to do it because there'll be unknowns if they have to play in the winter. There'll be unknowns then too, right? So They're, you know, it's probably, I think it's as good as they could do under the current circumstances.
It's really interesting to me to kind of watch, you know, the Big Sky Conference is saying it was a kick in the teeth that they canceled the non-conference games. They feel disappointed that they weren't even given an opportunity to meet the testing protocols. And the Big Sky Commissioner is now saying, hey, I can make an argument that it's safer for Idaho, 7 miles away from Washington State, for them to play that game than it is for Washington State to go to UCLA. Why do you think they canceled the non-conference? Was it about timing or was it about testing?
I think it was about testing. And I agree that it is safer for Idaho to play Washington State. And Washington State could even pay for Idaho's testing the week of the game, right, to make sure that there were no asymptomatic players on the field. But the problem is there's so few. I mean, the same could be said Portland State playing Oregon State, for instance. But there's so few of those games. You know, the vast majority of the non-conference games are teams where opponents have to get on a plane, and the vast majority are situations where, you know, one school doesn't have the money to do as much testing as the Pac-12 would feel comfortable doing. And the other component to it is if you keep it in the family, you can have the testing is all the same. You can test everybody on the same days of the week. You can put Pac-12 officials on the campuses to make sure there's no funny business, so that the star quarterback tests positive, but he's asymptomatic, and you still send him out on the field. And you can also protect the road teams, right? If the Pac-12 is only playing conference games, they can designate where the opponent's going to stay on Friday night. And if a kid gets sick on Friday night, the Pac-12, they can put that kid in the same quarantine or isolation place that the home team puts their guys. You just have so much more control over situation if there's positive tests or sick kids if you're just keeping it in the family.
John Wilner with us, San Jose Mercury News, Bay Area News Group. What are we waiting on here? Like, what are the markers that the conferences are looking at? Do they just, are they going to look up in 2 or 3 weeks and go, can we do it? Or are they looking for hard data? Or, you know, are they examining like the hot spots in the conference and saying, okay, we'll deal with the weakest link, and if we can do it, then we have the season. What are they looking at? Do you have any sense?
Well, I think what they're looking at is a September 19th start. You got to figure that they probably need to have training camp right around middle of August. And so, say 3 weeks, they're going to be looking at the coaches are going to be looking at the ADs. The ADs are going to be looking at the presidents are going to be looking at the local health authorities. And that's going to be the chain of command there. And if it's safe for teams to hold practices, and I don't know that it's going to be, right? It seems like, especially in Arizona and California, it seems like 3 weeks is probably not enough time for things to be safe enough for there to be full practices in a regular training camp. But again, that's why the schedule is the way it is. They could play, they could start on October 24th and play 8 games and be done on December for that title game on December 19th. September, from now to September 19th, the start date, that seems close, right? The too many good things have to happen in too short a time. But if you're not starting until late October, that's a whole different dynamic for the curve, I think, and they can still do it with that title game move pushed back to December 19th. They can start in October, late October, and still get a season in.
John Wilner with us at Wilner Hotline on Twitter. As you do these various interviews around the conference, I'm curious because I'm not out doing the other radio shows like you are. Are the questions the same in every market? Is it just come down to what's going to happen over again? Because I think ultimately you and I, if we agree on anything, would be none of us really knows. Like we're it's a moving target, isn't it?
Oh, it totally is. And when I was reporting and writing and publishing that article today, I'm like, you know what? This could very well all be for naught in 2-3 weeks, right? Because that. They may not be able to play. We may know then that they can't play 10 games. I mean, that's the thing, is it's all it's all just guesswork. It's all hoping that, you know, the case counts and positive rates go down and that they can play and that the campuses can have some kind of normal life, right? I mean, that's the other element to this is the situation across the campuses and within the communities and whether the presidents feel good about having student athletes competing, right? But, I mean, it's all in some ways just kind of hypothetical, right? And but at the same time, fans are dying, as you probably know. You know, fans are dying for they're hopeful, and they anything that's remotely concrete about that gives them hope, I think, is, you know, is important these days.
Is it possible that college basketball, men's and women's college basketball, follow suit with what happens to college football, meaning that if they can play, does that mean we should expect to see college basketball, or are those things independent of each other? You know, like the NBA trying to play and Major League Baseball trying to play, or the NFL, do they all have their own challenges?
I think they have their own challenges. Certainly, I see no way that there will be non-conference college basketball games. I mean, I think that is done. Unofficially, that is done. They're not going to play college basketball until probably January at the earliest, right? But if you think about basketball and football, in some ways basketball is easier because there's so many fewer numbers, right? You test 12 kids a couple times a week, but at the same time, you've got the indoor factor, right? And that's certainly, you know, indoor public health officials, at least in California, are much more wary of indoor activities than they are outdoor. So that's going to be part of the dynamic for basketball. But I just think a lot of it is about time for improvement in testing, time for vaccines or therapeutics. You know, we could end up seeing football start in late January, February, and we could see college basketball start in March for all we know. You know, they're going to want to get the season in, and if you, the longer you can wait, the better your shot.
Yeah, I think completely. If you are, you know, if you're the conference, you have to be focused on, first of all, football, because the revenue's there. Is there an update on Larry Scott, the conference commissioner? For those who don't know, the conference did confirm that he's got COVID-19. Is he working? Is he still quarantining? Is he working in downtown San Francisco? Do we know?
We know that he's working. My assumption is that he is working from home and is quarantining. And I have, you know, I don't want to spread misinformation, but my understanding is that he is doing okay. That this is not a case where, you know, hospitalization is required. I don't know if he is, you know, still, you know, in the shape that he was when they announced it, 10 days ago, almost 2 weeks ago, or if he's gotten better, but I don't believe he has had to be hospitalized, and I think he is still working.
I think it's fascinating, too, to follow the testing data school to school. Who's doing it right in the Pac-12, in your opinion?
Well, I think, and I know you have addressed this, you know, the transparency is important. I think that, believe it or not, I think that the private schools are in some ways kind of setting a good standard in terms of being transparent with the number of tests and the number of positive tests. Oregon State's doing it right. Washington's doing it right. Cal and Stanford, USC, Arizona. Those would be the ones I would single out as doing it right in terms of, you know, keeping the public informed and keeping the campus communities informed. The other ones are, to varying degrees, tight-lipped, right? Some of them have a complete cone of silence, and some of them are, like Oregon, just providing information on the total number of positive tests across campus. So it varies, but certainly, you know, in your area, the Beavers, I think, are doing a good job.
It's interesting because when I put out, like, I see the value of the university sharing publicly what the infection rates are, whether or not there's a spike within the football program. I don't see a privacy issue there because you're not identifying even a position group. I also think that there are people who are in contact with the football program on a basis on campus that would make this a health and safety issue. I'd sure like to know if I were working in proximity to the team, if they're having an outbreak. But I hear a lot of people when I bring that up Wilner, who will say, "Oh, only people who care about it are media." What do you say to that?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I think that there's plenty of people in the campus communities that would like to know. I mean, you know, I would point your readers to article that Ken Go wrote for the Oregonian, the great Ken Go, in which he spoke to a member of the Oregon campus community who said there was zero trust and that, you know, people wanted to know about the athletes because they come in contact with the athletes on a regular basis. And that happens at every one of these schools. There's hundreds of university employees that are in contact with student athletes, not just football players. And the more you know, the better. And I think that the universities need to do a public service for their employees as well as football fans and the media by at least sharing the raw test numbers, if not breaking it down by sport, at least tell us how many student athletes are positive.
All right. When I was a kid, I used to go to Candlestick Park. I would get the chocolate malt. I would get that balsa wood spoon, and I would eat that malt, and that spoon would splinter into pieces, and I'd probably end up eating the wooden spoon by the time I was done with it. But, man, that was a nostalgic memory. Do you have a memory of going to the stadium as a kid that sticks with you?
I do, and I'm going to assume that your malt just at Candlestick, it must have stayed frozen for the whole game. you know, my memory, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, and my memory is to go into, what are they called now? The Washington football team games.
Yep.
And they used to play at RFK Stadium. Yep. And my memory is going to a Washington versus Cowboys game Monday night. Was like, you know, in the 80s, and I'll never forget, Darryl Green ran down Tony Dorsett on a 90-yard touchdown run and caught him at, like, the 5-yard line.
Yep.
And the stadium was an old stadium. It was small, and it was shaking, and I was like, I thought I was going to fall off of the deck that I was standing on cheering because the stadium was rumbling the way it was.
I love that. I also heard from a little birdie that you were on vacation a week ago, and you spent some time in Central Oregon. I love that you're coming to our state and you're enjoying it. What'd you think? What'd you think of Central Oregon?
I loved it. I had never been there before. Our initial thought was, because we usually go to the East Coast and see family, we didn't do that. So figured, where could we drive and just rent a house and have some outdoor fun, right? Because it's all about being outdoors. And so we kind of started thinking about Bend, and then the more research we did, talked to some people, they said, "Oh, you should try Sun River." And so, yeah, we stayed at Sun River, and it was fantastic. Loved it. You just loved the whole area. We did a bunch of stuff on the Deschutes and the McKenzie, and went into Bend for two different times. And really enjoyed Bend. It was great. I mean, I would absolutely go back. The only issue for us is if you're driving, it's like an 8-hour drive, so you need to. It's not really a weekend for us, right?
Do you drive it in one shot, or do you go to like Redding halfway, or what do you do?
On the way up, we stopped. We spent the night in Klamath Falls, and then hiked Crater Lake. In fact, we were hiking Crater Lake when the Pac-12 was announcing it was canceling the non-conference schedule.
What do you do in that situation? You got your family there. You got a job to do. Are you live tweeting it, or are you going, "I'm on vacation"?
Well, I was basically resigned to going, "I'm on vacation," because I couldn't get reception. So there was a couple of times on the hike where I got a little bit of reception, and I get the reception, so I would freeze and try to get it to hold long enough to get on Twitter, and then I would lose reception and take another step and try to get back on. But it did not work out well. But you know what can you do? So on the way back, we actually drove. We did the whole thing, the whole 8 hours in one shot on the way back. We stopped at In-N-Out for dinner,
nice.
But otherwise we did a one shot.
That's amazing. I have had that same frustration where you're sitting there and you just can't, or you're tweeting, and it's going, "We were unable to send the tweet."
Yes,
unable to send the tweet.
Yes. And same with text messages. You know, it was bad timing, But the entire off season of college football has been basically this incredibly fluid, fast moving news cycle where there's something important happening, it seems, every day. There's no games, there's no practice, and yet there's something important happening every day.
It's amazing. Like, I'll put it in the suggestion box for Crater Lake. You need a cell tower at the top of Crater Lake just in case. No?
Yes, you do. The other thing you need at Crater Lake, I got to be honest, you need a few more people wearing masks. I was a little bit uncomfortable. There was a couple of spots on the trail, and we did the trail from the visitor center, and it was a little, it was fairly crowded, and there was just a few too many people without masks. I got to be honest. I was nervous.
I don't like that, man. It's disappointing. I mean, in these Oregonians, it's really disappointing. You had your mask on, though?
I did have my mask on. Yes. Okay. Because you can tweet with a mask on.
There you go. There you go. John Wilner, I appreciate you, man. I expect you to be moving to the state after having such a great experience.
It's fantastic up there. I would absolutely think about that.
Wilner, you're the best. Thanks for making time for us.
Stay safe, my friend.
All right. There he is. Crater Lake. The Deschutes River. Sun River, Oregon. He got a tour of the state. No wonder I beat him on that story in the news in the Pac-12. And now I know. He was up there at Crater Lake. He was reaching his hand up trying to get reception. Frustrated. His mask on. People breathing on him all around him. That's how you beat John Wilner on a story, ladies and gentlemen. You send him to Crater Lake. You got a shot. Leave it here. My wife's popping in studio next. Anna has popped into studio. She does it every day in the 2 o'clock hour. We have fascinating discussions on this show. It is also time to do the Culligan Water Cooler Report. It's brought to you by Culligan of Oregon. Essentially, the whole hour becomes kind of the Culligan Water Cooler Report because we're just standing around a water cooler talking. Well, here we go. Meet me at the
water cooler. Welcome to the Culligan Water Cooler Report. If we're talking about it, they'll be talking about it. Brought to you by Culligan Water Company.
You were laughing at John Wilner when he was describing being at Crater Lake trying to get reception. You're in the news business. How often has that happened?
More than I care to talk about. And it's funny because I also experience it as a spouse. Like now, you know, watching you in those situations,
sucks.
It's just... We've been there where you're trying to get a signal out. You're holding your cell phone up high above your head, trying to pick up, like, because you think that 12 inches above your head might actually make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty
where
desperate
feeling.
Where were
we when we were recently doing that? Where were we where we were recently holding the phone up? Were we in Central Oregon?
I think it was Central Oregon.
We were trying to get back because we were out at one of the lakes. We were at Cultus Lake.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We didn't. We hadn't dropped the trail of breadcrumbs.
Right.
And we were in separate cars.
Right.
And they had repaved a road while we were on the lake. This is what threw me.
That's right.
Because we went into the lake early in the morning. And then when we came to go out, the road had been repaved. It looked nothing like. Like you couldn't.
Right.
It was totally a new scene.
It was like, you know, the birds had come and they had eaten the breadcrumbs, so we didn't know our way home.
I got to the fork in the road and I went, why does this look like a spoon?
Yeah.
This was, and I had no reception, so I just went on instinct and eloped to me. Mm-hmm. I did get back.
Yeah, but. See, rookie mistake. I had actually screenshotted the map when we were on our way there.
Oh,
because
nice.
I thought, ooh, you know, cell phone reception is kind of shoddy
that
around
was smart.
Here. Let me screenshot this so at least I have the screenshot of it, a couple screenshots that might guide us out of here, but it's just such a rookie mistake.
I talked about you in the top of the show. Did you hear it?
No.
Did you happen to hear it?
No, I didn't.
Alabama, Adriana, Judah, do you remember what I said about my wife off the top of the show?
I think you said something about her being a supermodel.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That was part of it. I like that that's
part
the part that
yeah,
stuck
sorry,
with her.
Sorry about that, but... I mean, what can I say? Yeah, absolutely.
I was talking about brand, and essentially, like, brand of the Pac-12, brand of the NFL, brand, you know, like, what's your own brand, right? What's your family's brand? And I was saying, you got to kind of know who you are, like, what your good stories are. And I talked about, you know, the kids in the family and whatever. And, of course, the six-year-old being the smartest person in the family. And
for sure.
The four-year-old being the most daring person in the family. And probably the 17-year-old being the most caring person in the family.
Yeah, that's about right.
I said you were a supermodel, Emmy winner, all this successful stuff, voice of reason, my moral compass, all of that good stuff. If, as you look at, as a young person, how long did it take you to figure out kind of what you were about? Because I think you're very different as a kid. You grew up on Sandy Boulevard in Portland. You grew up running with your mom, a 28-unit motel. Motel with an M.
Yeah.
And you somehow, at about age 9 or 10, if I have the story right, kind of knew what you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably like 28 and didn't know what I was going to do. Like, explain.
Well, I learned later in life that English was actually my second language. I didn't know that. I didn't know until I watched an old VHS recording of myself on Ramblin' Rod, which, if you grew up in Portland, you knew it was like the guy who wore the buttons on KPTV and showed cartoons, only not really to his live.
Was he like Captain Kangaroo, but more regional?
Yeah, I guess.
You don't remember Captain Kangaroo?
Vaguely, vaguely know that.
Do you guys
reference.
Remember Captain Kangaroo? No?
Negative Ghost Rider.
Nobody. Never mind. Me neither.
That's funny because he just did like a Top Gun reference to your Captain Kangaroo reference.
Yeah. Yes.
So anyway, yeah, I didn't know that I spoke with a really heavy, like, Chinese accent at the age of 5 and 6. And so I learned English watching Three's Company and Peter Jennings. So I watched a lot of World News Tonight and just local news in general. And I think it shaped my worldview. And, you know, I guess somewhere along the way I decided that being a TV reporter was what I wanted to do.
Was that born of, all right, I'm at a motel, I've seen a lot of crime. You had prostitutes, you had drug users, you had stuff like that on that portion of Sandy Boulevard, you know. Being a crime fighter, you know, person who wanted to seek out justice and tell good stories? Or was it more born of, you know, achievement in general? Like, I have to think, you're a smart kid at that age. You know, you go to college, you get a scholarship, but, you know, was it more born of, hey, I want to be on TV, or I want to tell good stories, or both?
I think the biggest difference maker that really solidified my decision to become a journalist was... in high school, as a senior at Park Rose, we had tried and failed multiple times as a district to pass a school bond measure. And the school was literally falling apart. Like in, you know, the fall when we would have bad fall storms, we would have to set out buckets in the hallways to catch the rain that would drip through the ceiling. And we'd have to navigate around an obstacle course to get to class. And it was disappointing to me as a student that the adults in the community maybe didn't seem like they were aware of the conditions we were attending school in. Like, we would be, you know, in the gym playing volleyball, and if you hit the volleyball too high, the volleyball would strike the top of the small gym ceiling, and pieces of asbestos would come flying down.
Whoops.
It's just like, this just doesn't seem like really good, you know, learning conditions. And so I made it my goal before I left high school to do something that would make a difference for future generations. And I really felt like passing this bond measure to build a new high school building would matter. And so, you know, I founded like a student bond measure committee. We walked door to door. And ultimately, I realized in September of my senior year, when it failed again, we had one last chance. It would be in the November general election. And I don't know why I got the idea, but I called up the local TV stations after one of those really bad storms and invited them to come out. I said, you guys really should come out and take a look at the buckets that are in our hallways that are catching the rainwater that's dripping through. And they all came. They covered the story. And lo and behold, in November, the bond measure passed. And I think I witnessed for myself the power of local journalism and what can happen when you shine a light on an issue. And I thought that was pretty dang cool.
That's neat. And I think, too, it's one of those moments that bridges you to the next thing. And I often wondered, like, because as I got to know you, like, early in our relationship, you were walking into, like, meth houses and dangerous situations. And I was like, you were fearless. Is that born from, you know, we had a meth lab in the 28-unit hotel, or what is that born from?
Yeah, I mean, I'd already seen it all. I literally had seen it all. I saw what sex trafficking looked like because we would be actively trying to keep it away from our business. I saw murders, crime scenes at every motel on that stretch of Sandy Boulevard except for ours in the 15 years that we owned the motel. I saw drug dealing, drug making, really nothing fazed me. And I became sort of desensitized to all walks of life. And it's, you know, and frankly, I didn't know it at the time, but most of the families that were living at the motel, those were homeless folks. Those were homeless kids. They weren't, you know, choosing to live at that motel. It's because they really, that's all they could afford. And those were the kids that I played with. I didn't know any difference, you know. They were just kids to me.
I noticed that when we travel, all right, and we go, let's say we were recently driving to Central Oregon and we drove by Detroit Lake and we stopped for lunch. There was a little motel that was next door to the lunch place.
Yeah.
I look over at you. Your eyes are studying their sign, what they're offering. You're still, like, there's still part of you that is comparing your motel to their motel, isn't there?
It's so true. Yeah, I laugh when I see those little motels, those roadside motels, because they always advertise the stuff on their billboards that most places probably should have. Like, I remember we advertised, you know, TV, or maybe the big marketing thing was we had HBO. Ooh.
Phones.
And then this place that we were sitting next to for at lunch was advertising they have air-conditioned rooms, and maybe they had kitchenettes.
And then there was something blacked out on the on the sign, and you were like, I'm dying to know what was blacked out. HBO, probably.
Probably HBO.
Not in the plan anymore. We're not doing it. How did, like, what's the dirty little secret about the motel business that you know because you grew up in it that the rest of us maybe don't know?
Oh, gosh. Never the first thing you do when you go into a hotel or a motel. Like, hotels, you have a far greater chance that they've washed all of the bed covers, but there's still a high probability that they have reused that comforter cover from the previous guest. Like, I immediately go into any establishment like that and just rip the comforter or that top layer off, because most places don't wash those like daily. They wash them monthly. So just think about that.
It's disgusting.
It's so gross. And they don't wipe down the remotes. They don't wipe down definitely the remote. Like, you should go and just sanitize, you know, common surfaces.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.